9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Coming up on today's Speakeasy podcast, we're talking with Fear the Walking Dead's Kim Dickens, who explains to us why zombie shows are so popular these days.
It's the metaphor. Metaphors for our anxieties and fears, deep ones or our daily ones. They're just always there, creeping up on you, and you're just slaying zombies left and right. Aren't we all, like every day?
This is WSJ Speakeasy, your source for entertainment, pop culture, celebrity, and the arts.
Hello, welcome to the Wall Street Journal Speakeasy podcast. My name is Mike Ayers. I'm an arts and entertainment reporter here at the Journal. Today's guest is one of the most prolific actors working today, Kim Dickens. Over the last 15 years, she's been in pretty much every great show, from Deadwood to Lost to Friday Night Lights to Sons of Anarchy. The list goes on. Now she stars in AMC's Fear the Walking Dead as Maddie, the matriarch of the survivors, as well as a featured role on Netflix's delicious political drama House of Cards. Kim, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So when you were first starting off, did you ever think you'd one day be acting next to zombies?
No, I didn't imagine that. I don't know what I imagined, but it certainly wasn't that.
You were trained here in New York, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Was that the early 90s when you were here?
Yeah, could have been. Yeah, I was here. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. I started out, did a little summer program first at Lee Strasberg Theater Institute at NYU. And from there, I studied with private teachers and just, you know, I still study.
You still study. Yeah. Well, I mean, what were those early days like for you? Was it did you find it tough?
I loved it. I loved living in New York City. I loved being in acting school. I was a waitress. I was able to pay rent in Manhattan and go to auditions in Manhattan, which it doesn't really happen anymore. So it was a pretty exciting time.
Where were you living?
Well, I lived in the East Village. I lived in Chelsea, a couple of different places. And for the longest period, I lived directly across the street from the Chelsea Hotel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rent prices back then, what were those like?
I think it started at $418.
$418?
Yeah.
$418?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's like back in the olden times.
My cheap rent in 2004 for a really tiny place on the Upper East Side was $1,200. So
that's pretty good.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's not $418 good, but it's still pretty good. I mean, did you find living in the city tough then? I mean, you were young, right, at that time?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big city. It's very competitive. Did you find it that way at all?
I don't think I was really aware of the competitiveness of it. I was young, and I moved up here without knowing anyone. I just went into school, and, you know, it was probably rougher then. You know, it was pretty exciting, and so at times it felt dangerous, you know. But as far as competitiveness, you know, once I started going on auditions and things like that for my career, because I was here for several years without that. Once I started going, I don't know. I just thought it was, sometimes I would question myself, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? You know, it just seemed like such a crapshoot. But I knew it's what I love to do, and I just didn't think too much about it. I just kept showing up and trying and, you know, showing up in those audition rooms with a ton of girls. Some are who I see working now, you know, still, you
know, they're still doing it.
Sure. Well, still, you know, working and everything.
They had that same, I mean, like that same focus. Like was there any alternative in your mind, or was this kind of it?
Yeah, that was the scary thing. I didn't have an alternative.
Yeah. Were you a good waitress?
I was.
You were?
Yeah.
Where at?
You want the list or you want the main place?
The main place.
Cowgirl Hall of Fame.
I don't know what that is.
Really?
What is that?
It's a southern restaurant.
Okay.
and down in the West Village on Hudson and 10th Street. It's been there for forever.
It still exists?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's great. It was on Sex and the City. It's great Southern
great
food,
Southern
music.
Food.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. What was your the family back in Alabama's thoughts about this? I mean, were they concerned of this career choice?
Yeah, I think they were. My father was a musician and singer and songwriter and artist, so I was exposed to things like that, that sort of culture. But I don't think that, you know, no one had ever really ventured out and tried to do what I was doing. And my mother was just concerned for, you know, she wanted me to be okay and be taken care of in a career that I chose. And so at times she thought, why don't you come home and be a newscaster, you know? And I said, well, it's not that I just want to be on TV. I don't think I want to be a journalist or, you know. And then she suggested maybe try something behind the scenes, and nothing was clicking. So anyway, she's always been very supportive.
So what was the
protective?
What was the biggest thing that you cite or you think that really helped you break into the industry? Because I mean, that's like a thing that I think, you know, is perpetual for whatever career you're trying to go for. You know, whether it's being a writer or a marketer or actor or whatever you want. You know, how do you break into it?
I don't know. It was sort of a fluke in a way, it seems like. I mean, I'd been to school. I'd been to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and I'd graduated from there and been out of school for a while and started a theater company with some friends and just was doing things that way, grassroots. And friends recommended another class to take with this teacher called by the name of Dina Levy. And I went into that class just to take another class once a week. I went into that class and it kind of felt like things clicked for me. Everything that I'd learned sort of gelled in that class. It just all sort of came together and made the most sense there. She's a wonderful teacher. She still teaches. And a lot of the actors in there they all had agents and they were working. And there were so many facets to the class, but one of the things was, you know, it sort of focused on owning what works about you. Stop trying to change things about yourself and just be very present in yourself. And it sort of taught me how to walk into the room, like the audition rooms and stuff like that, a starting place to then do the work. And for me, that felt like a big moment.
Yeah, I feel like learning presence, you know, like the ability to be present.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of in fashion right now, but you have to, you know, you have to really teach yourself how to do that, or at least have somebody tell you, you know, this is how you get ahead if you want to, you know, really, really succeed. And then, but it's, you can tell somebody, but it's not that easy to learn necessarily.
No, it's not.
Do you consider yourself kind of a goal-oriented person? Like back then, did you give yourself timelines? Were you very, you know, in head down pursuit of goals?
No. I kind of just went where the wind took me at times. But I finally put my head down at once and I said, I have to get real pictures, and I got some pictures, and then I said, all right, I got to send them out, and I think I sent out, because you would go buy the stickers at Samuel French. I feel so old talking to you, Mike. You're bringing up all this. You did say you were going to go back far. Well, so you go buy these stickers at Samuel French bookstore of all the places you could send out your headshot before it was, you know, before they begged you to not send them anymore. So I think one weekend I got through like 35, and I sent out 35.
And that worked?
I got called in for one of them, and then I got the job, and then I got an agent. So I don't know if it's just, you know, timing. It's so much of it is luck. There's talent, and there's also, it takes perseverance, you know.
And optimism, too.
Sure.
I mean, you have to be an optimistic person to sit on a weekend in New York City, mm-hmm. you know, not go out, not party, just stuff envelopes.
Yep.
With your head in the envelope.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And hope for the best.
Yeah.
And you have to be a little glass full type of person to want to do that, as well as having all those other things,
right.
Perseverance and luck and some nice timing.
Yeah.
So that big break, what do you consider that big break for you that really kind of sets you on the path that you've done in the last 5-10 years?
The big break from the very beginning or the one in the last 5-10 years?
Yeah, well, the one that you credit as just like the turning point of your career.
Well, I think the first job I got mm-hmm. was a big deal, and that was Palookaville, directed by Alan Taylor. And it was, as I began to get closer and closer on that job auditioning for it, the casting agent said, let me set up some meetings for you with agents. And I got an agent, and then I ended up getting the job. And that was a huge turning point. And I went in there after thinking it was some non-union job, and I got in there, and I went to the sign-in sheet, and I saw everyone's name on there with big agencies next to their name, and I didn't know what I was doing in there. But anyway, got that. And then I would say turning point later on would be probably Deadwood, because I think for most of us on that show, we'd all had a career and certainly been working, but something sort of crystallized in that moment was a turning point for many of us.
What was that audition like?
Deadwood?
Yeah.
I didn't audition for it.
You didn't audition for it?
No, because I'd done a series with David Milch before called Big Apple.
Right.
On CBS, and it should have been on cable, you know. It lasted like 8 episodes. It was meant for cable. But I had gone in and met him on that, and he'd cast me on that. And so, you know, I wasn't in the first 2 episodes of Deadwood, and when they wrote the new character, he thought of me for it.
That's nice.
It's very nice.
Yeah. So that. So in a weird way, I guess Big Apple was kind of the break before
sure.
the break.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
Why did that show only last 8 episodes?
It was dense.
It was dense.
Yeah. It was great. It was FBIs and cops working together in Manhattan.
It was dark. It was gritty.
Funny.
It was funny.
Too funny as well.
Yeah,
just the way Deadwood
well.
Is. You know what I mean? The way. Ed O'Neill was the lead. He was fantastic.
As always.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great group. David Strathairn.
So what was it about Deadwood that you think kind of connected with people? I mean, it didn't, you know, go, you know, 8 seasons, but people certainly, it certainly has a very active cult fan base still to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's cited in the industry behind the scenes, like Pete, you know, is as you know, as an actor's, producer's, a writer's TV show, like they look to that for inspiration. It seems like, I don't know, what do you think really connected with that show?
I don't know. I mean, I think they, you know, it was an example of giving creative license to this real creative genius. And I mean, it took courage on HBO's part. We didn't have full scripts, you know. We would show up at pages at a time, and I think David, you know, he picked the actors who were malleable and easy to work with in that way. And he was on set with us all the time. He was inspired by real life things that were happening for people and would write that into the show and at times. And I think, you know, David gave creative license to Janie Bryant, the costume designer. I mean, she said to me, they never said a thing to me. They just let her go. And she was brilliant, you know.
At the time, and, you know, I think at that point you had been, you know, around a lot of sets at that point. I mean, was that, did you consider that pretty revolutionary when you were like showing up to work? Like how crazy that seems? Because, you know, TV shows are a big production, lots of cooks in the kitchen, you know, lots of suits in the kitchen as well, you know. But, you know, that certainly seems like it was a very creative outlet for everybody.
It was.
And maybe that was what fostered everything that just from the the performances and the stories and just what he was able to get out of everybody. Mm-hmm. That atmosphere maybe was part of it.
I think it was magical how creative it was, really. It was like, you know, when you would be at work at night and see the thoroughfare, working in exteriors, see the thoroughfare lit up at night, it was just, it sparkled. The show just sparkled because I think there was that amount of creative freedom to it and heart in it and faith without, you know, I think the suits were probably afraid to come out there to the set, you know, because it was unorthodox, really, the way it was being done. And so I think that gave to the magic of it. But you'd be on set and it's like we'd all been on sets, but nothing quite like that. Like it was special, and it's, you stand there and you'd think, yeah, this is why I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to pretend here.
Yeah. It sounds like a transformative experience.
Yeah.
Does that seem like forever ago? That was like in the middle of last decade.
It really does.
It does.
Is it about 9 years now?
Not like 9, 10 years.
10 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, we really should have done the movies, you know. And I think they're still bound to happen. I know I've had my lunch with David recently. I know he's writing. It's all very exciting and as close as it's ever been. I think everybody would be, you know, jump through hoops to make it happen, you know, actor-wise, as far as making schedules work.
Sure,
and stuff.
Sure, yeah. All right, good. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Kim Dickens today.
I'm Veronica Dagger, and I want to retire rich. How about you? Then listen to the Watching Your Wealth podcast. We'll help you get there. For more information, check us out at wsj.com/podcasts and find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. This is WSJ Speakeasy, your source for entertainment, pop culture, celebrity, and the arts.
Hello, welcome back. Today we're talking with Kim Dickens from Fear the Walking Dead. Kim, with this show, with Fear the Walking Dead, you have the luxury of working on a program that has a pretty rabid fan base. How's that experience been for you so far?
I've enjoyed it. I mean, we were lucky to have a very passionate, mobilized audience that was created and earned by The Walking Dead. We were fortunate to have them look our way. Give us a chance. And I think, you know, some have stuck around. So I feel like we have a nice dedicated fan base right now. And it's fun. It's fun to have that much energy around a show. You know it's being seen. You know people are excited about it. You know there's a lot of fan interaction. There's a live Talking Dead show that we do afterwards with fan interaction. And, it's fun.
And they dissect everything.
Yeah, there's that.
Everything, every word, every, like...
There's
that head scratch that you may do. They look for meaning when sometimes people just have to scratch their head.
Yep.
I'm certainly one of those people at a time. You know, you've been in this world for what, like a year, year and a half now, working on this show?
Yeah.
For the most part.
So.
You know, I don't know. What's your big takeaway on why it connects with people? Like what it speaks to, I guess... You know, the zombie genre, it's very popular, but, you know, it's always curious about why people like to show up and watch dead people potentially eat other people.
I know. It's
crazy.
It's perplexing. All I can think is that it's the metaphor, you know, that it allows, I think. It's this, because really... I think they're metaphors. The Walking Dead are metaphors for our anxieties and fears, deep ones or our daily ones. Hmm. It's like they're just always there, creeping up on you, and you're just slaying zombies left and right. aren't we all, like, every day, you know? So, I mean, there's that, but it's also the genre allows for this, you know, heightened world with high stakes and you know, and you can play out these I think very primitive fears that we have, like, what if I can't protect my family or myself? What if the government betrays me? What if there is an outbreak, a virus? You know, what if, and what would I do, and how would I, where would I be willing to go? How would my moral compass change? And I think people can sort of relieve some of that anxiety by, you know, playing it out, you know, viscerally experiencing it through the show, and then they can turn it off and have their better life.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does speak exactly to what you're saying, like the anxieties. That was a good description about, you know, things creeping up around you. That's what zombies do, you know. They're not very fast.
They're not swift.
They're not Olympic sprinters by any means, but, you know, they are fearful, and there's a certain, I guess, paranoia that, you know, Kirkman and the folks love to mm-hmm. constantly introduce, whether it's human on human paranoia mm-hmm. and or, you know, zombie on human paranoia. And the idea of making quick decisions and what you can be, and this is what this season seems to really be exploring in everybody, some more, you know, than others, but your character specifically seems like she's, you know, really realizing what's at stake. Mm-hmm. And there's people that eat people, but that's not really what is the most scary aspect about this new reality. It's what humans have turned into.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And this must be, you know, looking at your body of work, you know, you have, you know, she seems like such a new type of person for you to explore. Would you say that's pretty accurate?
Yes and no. I mean, at first glance for me it was, and then the more I get into it, the more I realize, you know, I'm familiar with playing women who are struggling or have been from somewhere, been through something that maybe we don't know what it is,
yes.
but somehow we root for her, and she's
yes.
not a victim. So I also realize, as at first, you know, at first I thought the genre was not for me, or I was not for the genre. I had not done the genre before and didn't think I'd fit in. And then I start to realize, you know, Deadwood and Tremé were both apocalyptic in the way. I mean, Deadwood was a Wild West, a lawless community where disease was rampant and no one was protected. And then Tremé, they, right post-Katrina in New Orleans, felt betrayed by their government and, you know, victims of natural disasters. So the stakes were life or death in all of those shows.
Yeah, when did you make that connection? Because it's a very, you know, intriguing connection, you know, that the Wild West, the zombie apocalypse, the post-Katrina, they all can kind of start to feel the same, you
mm-hmm.
know? It's just a different context.
Mm-hmm.
Was the first season pretty much done when you kind of realized that, or were you kind of like, you know?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, good. You know, we talked about the Walking Dead fan base, and, you know, we have so many options for consuming television and movies these days. Is the industry tougher, do you think, these days than versus, like, maybe 10 or 20 years ago? Like, there's more opportunity, but it's maybe harder to find, you know, people to watch because there's just so much choice.
I don't know if the industry is tougher. I just know... I can't speak to that, really.
Yeah.
I don't know, because I have been on, you know, I've gone from Tremé to, well, as far as streaming and television go, from Tremé to House of Cards to, you know, back onto cable.
Cable.
Yeah.
Yeah, everywhere.
It's AMC. And so I just know, as a viewer, it's hard to find the time, all the shows I want to watch that are out there, because there's such an abundance of material.
Do you watch a lot of TV?
I don't have as much time as I'd like to. So I feel like there's a lot of shows. Like, I want to watch second season of Fargo so badly, and I can't, you know. I saw Broad City. I love Broad City, so I finally saw that
one. There you go. There you go.
You know, but.
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly amount of, the amount of choice that a viewer has is, you know, it just keeps kind of expanding. It seems
like every, do you think? What do you think it does, is done to the business?
It's, well, it's, the opportunity for people is great,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's a lot of great talented people and, you know, there's opportunity for new people coming up. You know, your show, Fear the Walking Dead, features a lot of new faces,
right?
In my opinion. I hadn't seen them before. They yeah. probably had been working, but this was their break. This was yeah. this is their Deadwood,
mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways. And you know, that's good. You know, 10 years ago, there's no shows about zombies on a major cable network. You know, just the things that people can do and play with and storytelling, it's great. Now, who has the amount of time to consume all of this? Like, you really have to, I think, as you were just saying, like, just pick things and, you know, kind of hope for the best.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no fear of missing out. You have to leave the fear of missing out feelings aside. But, you know, the internet can fuel all of that. I think the internet, you know, can create, social media creates a lot of unneeded anxiety. I learned this recently. I turned off all of my social media and email for 8 days, okay, and mm-hmm. just disconnected with everything. And I came back and I was like, those things make me feel like anxious a lot
yeah.
because I see the constant chatter of what, you know, people are consuming and loving and watching, and it's, you know, do I need to be doing this? Should I not be doing this and doing this? And mm-hmm. it's just like this constant circle of questions spinning around in my head. So, you know, I think it's just, I don't know how people have time to watch everything. But, you know, I don't know. Are you an internet person?
Am I an internet person?
Yeah. Do you use the internet a lot?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah. But I'm not up to speed on my social media. Like, I have just one foot in there. You know, I know that I should do more, and yet I do other things instead. Like, I just sort of live.
Yeah. It seems like, yeah, either, well, it seems like you're working all the time. Do you
yeah,
feel like
but
you're
I
working
see,
all the time?
I see some people that are able to work and get things and then stockpile things and they're ready to go. And it's fun. I can see how it's really mm-hmm. fun, but I'm just doing other things.
Okay.
But yes, I am working a lot of it.
Does do you think fear has a pretty healthy shelf life? Is it going to keep you busy for a while?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I think it could. I think there's so many places to go with the story as we're already sort of, as it's already showing. I mean, there's so many avenues to explore this sort of early on in the apocalypse, so and in a different country. So I hope so. I'm actually really enjoying it.
All right, good. Well, thanks, Kim, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
All right, thanks for tuning in today. For more podcasts, check us out at wsj.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @WSJPodcast. Become a subscriber on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify. And now look for us on the Google Play Music app on Android devices. Thanks for listening.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.